7. Point of view and voice. I saw that he was lost in his memories, like a boat that drifts on its own reflection. Point of view, POV for short, is the technical term for who is telling the story and what their relation to the story is. This person, if a character in the story, is called the viewpoint character. The only other person it can be is the author. Voice is a word critics often use in discussing narrative. It's always metaphorical, since what's written is voiceless until read aloud. Often, voice is a kind of shorthand for authenticity, writing in your own voice, catching the true voice of a person, and so on. I'm using it naively and pragmatically to mean the voice or voices that tell the story, the narrating voice. In this book, at this point, I'll treat voice and point of view as so intimately involved and interdependent as to be the same thing. The principal points of view. What follows is my attempt to define and describe the 5 principal narrative points of view. Each description is followed by an example, a paragraph told in that POV from a non-existent story called Princess Sephrod. It's the same scene each time, the same people, the same events. Only the viewpoint changes. A note on the reliable narrator. In autobiography and memoir, in nonfiction narrative of any kind, the I, whether the writer uses it or not, is the author. In these forms, we normally expect the author, narrator, to be reliable, to try honestly to tell us what they think happened, not to invent, but to relate. The immense difficulty of relating facts honestly has been used to justify the choice not to relate facts honestly. Some nonfiction writers, claiming fiction's privilege of invention, deliberately alter facts in order to present a truth superior to what merely happened. The memoirists and nonfiction writers I respect are fully aware of the impossibility of being perfectly factual and wrestle with it as with an angel, but never use it to excuse lying. In fiction, however autobiographical, confessional it may be, the narrator is by definition fictive. All the same, most narrators, first or third person, in serious fiction, used to be trustworthy. But our shifty age favors unreliable narrators who, deliberately or innocently, misrepresent the facts. The motivation here is very different from that of the dishonest nonfiction writer. Fictional narrators who suppress or distort facts or make mistakes in relating or interpreting the events are almost always telling us something about themselves and perhaps about us. The author lets us see or guess what really happened, and using this as a touchstone, we readers are led to understand how other people see the world and why they, and we, see it that way. A familiar example of a semi-reliable narrator is Huck Finn. Huck is an honest person, but he misinterprets a good deal of what he sees. For instance, he never understands that Jim is the only adult in his world who treats him with love and honor, and he never really understands that he loves and honors Jim. The fact that he can't understand it tells us an appalling truth about the world he and Jim and we live in. Princess Sephrod, as you will see by comparing her relation with those of other viewpoint characters, is entirely reliable. First person. In first person narration, the viewpoint character is I. I tells the story and is centrally involved in it. Only what I knows, feels, perceives, thinks, guesses, hopes, remembers, etc., can be told. The reader can infer what other people feel and who they are only from what I sees, hears, and says of them. Princess Sephrid, first-person narration. I felt so strange and lonesome entering the room crowded with strangers that I wanted to turn around and run. But Rasa was right behind me, and I had to go ahead. People spoke to me, asked Rasa my name. In my confusion, I couldn't tell one face from another or understand what people were saying to me and answered them almost at random. Only for a moment, I caught the glance of a person in the crowd, a woman looking directly at me, and there was a kindness in her eyes that made me long to go to her. She looked like somebody I could talk to. Limited third person. The viewpoint character is he or she. He or she tells the story and is centrally involved in it. Only what the viewpoint character knows, feels, perceives, thinks, guesses, hopes, remembers, etc., can be told. The reader can infer what other people feel and are only from what the viewpoint character observes of their behavior. This limitation to the perceptions of one person may be consistent throughout a whole book, or the narrative may shift from one viewpoint character to another. Such shifts are usually signaled in some way, and usually don't happen at very short intervals. Tactically, limited third is identical to first person. It has exactly the same essential limitation that nothing can be seen, known, or told except what the narrator sees, knows, and tells. That limitation concentrates the voice and gives apparent authenticity. It seems that you could change the narration from first to limited third person by merely instructing the computer to switch the pronoun, then correct verb endings throughout, and voila. But it isn't that simple. First person is a different voice from limited third. The reader's relationship to that voice is different because the author's relationship to it is different. Being I is not the same as being he or she. In the long run, it takes a quite different imaginative energy, both for the writer and for the reader. There is no guarantee, by the way, that the limited third-person narrator is reliable. Stream of consciousness is a particularly inward form of limited third-person. Princess Sephrid, limited third-person. Sephrid felt isolated, conspicuous, as she entered the room, crowded with strangers. She would have turned around and run back to her room, but Rasa was right behind her, and she had to go ahead. People spoke to her. They asked Rasa her name. In her confusion, she could not tell one face from another or understand what people said to her. She answered them at random. Only once, for a moment, a woman looked directly at her through the crowd, a keen, kind gaze that made Sephrid long to cross the room and talk to her. Involved author, omniscient author. The story is not told from within any single character. There may be numerous viewpoint characters, and the narrative voice may change at any time from one to another character within the story, or to a view, perception, analysis, or prediction that only the author could make. For example, the description of what a person who is quite alone looks like, or the description of a landscape or a room at a moment when there's nobody there to see it. The writer may tell us what anyone is thinking and feeling, interpret behavior for us, and even make judgments on characters. This is the familiar voice of the storyteller who knows what's going on in all the different places the characters are at the same time, and what's going on inside the characters, and what has happened, and what has to happen. All myths and legends and folk tales, all young children's stories, almost all fiction until about 1915, and a vast amount of fiction since then, use this voice. I don't like the common term omniscient author, because I hear a judgmental sneer in it. I prefer involved author. Authorial narration is a neutral term which I will also use. Limited third person is the predominant modern fictional voice, partly in reaction to the Victorian fondness for involved author narration and the many possible abuses of it. Involved author is the most openly, obviously manipulative of the points of view. But the voice of the narrator, who knows the whole story, tells it because it is important and is profoundly involved with all the characters, cannot be dismissed as old-fashioned or uncool. It's not only the oldest and the most widely used storytelling voice, it's also the most versatile, flexible, and complex of the points of view, and probably, at this point, the most difficult for the writer. Princess Sefrid, involved author, omniscient author. The Tufarian girl entered the room hesitantly, her arms close to her sides, her shoulders hunched. She looked both frightened and indifferent, like a captured wild animal. The big Hemian ushered her in with a proprietary air and introduced her complacently as Princess Sefrid, or the Princess of Tufar. People pressed close, eager to meet her or simply to stare at her. She endured them, seldom raising her head, replying to their inanities briefly, in a barely audible voice. Even in the pressing, chattering crowd, she created a space around herself, a place to be lonely in. No one touched her. They were not aware that they avoided her, but she was. Out of that solitude she looked up, to meet a gaze that was not curious, but open, intense, compassionate. A face that said to her, through the sea of strangeness, "I am your friend." Detached author, fly on the wall, camera eye, objective narrator. There is no viewpoint character. The narrator is not one of the characters and can say of the characters only what a totally neutral observer, an intelligent fly on the wall, might infer of them from behavior and speech. The author never enters a character's mind. People and places may be exactly described, but values and judgments can only be implied indirectly. A popular voice around 1900, and in minimalist and brand-name fiction, it is the least overtly, most covertly manipulative of the points of view. It's excellent practice for writers who expect codependent readers. When we're new at writing, we may expect our readers to respond just as we respond to what we're writing about, to cry because we're crying. But this is a childish, not a writerly relation to the reader. If you can move a reader while using this cool voice, you've got something really moving going on. Princess Sefrid, Detached author. Fly on the wall. Camera eye. Objective narrator. The princess from Too Far entered the room, followed closely by the big man from Hem. She walked with long steps, her arms close to her sides and her shoulders hunched. Her hair was thick and frizzy. She stood still while the Hemian introduced her, calling her Princess Sefrid of Too Far. Her eyes did not meet the eyes of any of the people who crowded around her, staring at her and asking her questions. None of them tried to touch her. She replied briefly to everything said to her. She and an older woman near the tables of food exchanged a brief glance. Observer narrator using the first person. The narrator is one of the characters, but not the principal character. Present, but not a major actor in the events. The difference from first-person narration is that the story is not about the narrator. It's a story the narrator witnessed and wants to tell us. Both fiction and non-fiction use this voice. Princess Sefrid, observer narrator in first person. She wore Tufarian clothing, the heavy red robes I had not seen for so long. Her hair stood out like a storm cloud around the dark, narrow face. Crowded forward by her owner, the Hemian slave master called Rasa, she looked small, hunched, defensive, but she preserved around herself a space that was all her own. She was a captive, an exile. Yet I saw in her young face the pride and kindness I had loved in her people, and I longed to speak with her. Observer narrator using the third person. This point of view is limited to fiction. The tactic is much the same as the last one. The viewpoint character is a limited third-person narrator who witnesses the events. As unreliability is a complex and subtle way of showing the narrator's character, and the observer narrator isn't the protagonist, the reader is usually safe in assuming that this viewpoint character is fairly reliable, or at least transparent, both in first and third person. Princess Sefrid, observer narrator in third person. She wore Tufarian clothing, the heavy red robes Anna had not seen for 15 years. Crowded forward by her owner, the Hemian slave master called Rasa, the princess looked small, hunched, defensive. But she preserved around herself a space that was all her own. She was a captive, an exile. Yet Anna saw in her young face the pride and kindness she had loved in the Tufarians, and longed to speak with her. Further reading. Look at a bunch of stories in an anthology, or pull down a bunch of novels from your shelf, from as wide a span of time as possible, and identify the viewpoint characters, and the points of view of the narration. Notice if they change, and if so, how often? Considerations on changing point of view. I'm going into all this detail because the narrative problem I have met most often in workshop stories, and often in published work, is in handling POV, inconsistency and frequent changes of POV. It's a problem even in nonfiction when the author starts telling the reader what Aunt Jane was thinking and why Uncle Fred swallowed the grommet. A memoirist doesn't have the right to do this without clearly indicating that Aunt Jane's thoughts and Uncle Fred's motives aren't known facts, but the author's guesswork, opinion, or interpretation. Memoirists can't be omniscient, even for a moment. In fiction, inconsistent POV is a very frequent problem, unless handled with awareness and skill. Frequent POV shifts jerk the reader around, bouncing in and out of incompatible identifications, confusing emotion, garbling the story. Any shift from one of the five POVs outlined above to another is a dangerous one. It's a major change of voice to go from first to third person, or from involved author to observer narrator. The shift will affect the whole tone and structure of your narrative. Shifts within limited third person, from one character's mind to another's, call for equal awareness and care. A writer must be aware of, have a reason for, and be in control of all shifts of viewpoint character. I feel like writing the last two paragraphs all over again, but that would be rude. Could I ask you to read them over again? The POV exercises are intended to make you temporarily super conscious and forever conscious of what POV you're using and when and how you shift it. Limited third is, at present, the person most fiction writers are most used to using. First person is, of course, the voice memoirists mostly use. I think it's a good idea for all of us to try all the other possibilities. Fiction writers are used to writing in other people's voices, being other selves. But memoirists aren't. To use limited third person in factual narrative is to trespass, pretending you know what another real person thought and felt. But there's no problem with pretending you know what somebody you invented thinks and feels. So I recommend that, just for the exercise, memoirists invent a story, make up characters, in the shameless way fiction writers do. Exercise 7. Points of view. Think up a situation for a narrative sketch of 200 to 350 words. It can be anything you like, but should involve several people doing something. Several means more than two. More than three will be useful. It doesn't have to be a big, important event, though it can be. But something should happen. Even if only a cart tangle at the supermarket, a wrangle around the table concerning the family division of labor, or a minor street accident. Please use little or no dialogue in these POV exercises. While the characters talk, their voices cover the POV. And so you're not exploring that voice, which is the point of the exercise. Part 1. Two voices. First, tell your little story from a single POV, that of a participant in the event, an old man, a child, a cat, whatever you like. Use limited third person. Second, retell the story from the POV of one of the other people involved in it. Again, use limited third person. As we go on into the next parts of this exercise, if your little scene or situation or story runs dry, invent another one along the same lines. But if the original one seems to keep turning up new possibilities in different voices, just go on exploring them through it. That will be the most useful, informative way to do the exercise. Part 2. Detached narrator. Tell the same story using the detached author, or fly-on-the-wall POV. Part 3. Observer narrator. If there wasn't a character in the original version who was there, but was not a participant, only an onlooker, add such a character now. Tell the same story in that character's voice, in first or third person. Part 4. Involved author. Tell the same or a new story using the involved author POV. Part 4. may require you to expand the whole thing up to 2 or 3 pages, 1,000 words or so. You may find you need to give it a context, find out what led up to it, or follow it further. The detached author takes up as little room as possible, but the involved author needs a fair amount of time and space to move around in. If your original story simply doesn't lend itself to this voice, find a story you want to tell that you can be emotionally and morally involved in. I don't mean by that it has to be factually true. If it is, you may have trouble getting out of the autobiographical mode into the involved author's voice, which is a fictional mode. And I don't mean that you should use your story to preach. I do mean that the story should be about something that concerns you. Note, unspoken thoughts. Many writers worry about how to present characters' unspoken thoughts. Editors are likely to put thoughts into italics if you don't stop them. Thoughts are handled exactly like dialogue if you present them directly. Heavens, Aunt Jane thought, he's eating that grommet. But in presenting characters' thoughts, you don't have to use quotation marks, and using italics or any typographical device can overemphasize the material. Just make it clear that this bit is going on inside somebody's head. Ways of doing so are various. As soon as she heard Jim shout, Aunt Jane knew Fred had swallowed the grommet after all. I just know he's going to swallow that grommet again, Jane said to herself as she sorted buttons. Oh, Jane thought, I do wish the old fool would hurry up and swallow that grommet. In critiquing these exercises in point of view, and in thinking and talking about them later, various strong preferences for certain voices and points of view may come out. It can be interesting to consider and discuss them. Later on, you may want to return to some of these exercises, using the instructions on a different story, perhaps recombining the exercises. The choice of points of view, the voice in which one narrates one's story, can make an immense difference to the tone, the effect, even the meaning of the story. Writers often find that a story they want to tell sticks and won't go right until they find the right person to tell it, whether it's a choice between first and third person, or between the involved author and a limited third-person narrator, or between a character involved in the action and a bystander, or between one and several narrators. The following optional exercises might help bring out the wealth of choices and the necessity of choosing. Optional additions to Exercise 7. Tell a different story with both versions in the first person instead of limited third. Or tell the story of an accident twice, once in the detached author mode or in a journalistic repertorial voice, then from the viewpoint of a character involved in the accident. If there's a mode or voice you don't particularly like, that's probably the one you should try again, if only to find out why you dislike it. I'm sure you'll like your tapioca, if you'll just try it, dear. Because omniscience is out of fashion, and some readers aren't used to a narrator who admits to knowing the whole story, I thought it might be useful to offer some examples of the involved authorial POV. Two of them are Victorian, with all the excesses and all the vitality of the shamelessly engaged narrator. This paragraph from Uncle Tom's Cabin describes the slave Eliza running away, having learned that her child is to be sold. Example 11. Harriet Beecher Stowe from Uncle Tom's Cabin. The frosty ground creaked beneath her feet, and she trembled at the sound. Every quaking leaf and fluttering shadow sent the blood backward to her heart and quickened her footsteps. She wondered within herself at the strength that seemed to be come upon her, for she felt the weight of her boy as if it had been a feather, and every flutter of fear seemed to increase the supernatural power that bore her on, while from her pale lips burst forth, in frequent ejaculations, the prayer to a friend above, "Lord, help! Lord, save me!" If it were your Harry, mother, or your Willie that were going to be torn from you by a brutal traitor tomorrow morning, if you had seen the man and heard that the papers were signed and delivered, and you had only from 12 o'clock till morning to make good your escape, how fast could you walk? How many miles could you make in those few brief hours, with the darling at your bosom, the little sleepy head on your shoulder, the small, soft arms trustingly holding on to your neck? The power of such scenes is, of course, cumulative. But even in this fragment I find the author's sudden turn to the reader startling and moving. How fast could you walk? Example 12 is the first pages of the first three chapters of Dickens's Bleak House. The first two chapters are in the involved authorial voice, present tense. The third is in the first person, past tense, the narrator being the character Esther Summerson. The chapters alternate this way throughout the book, an unusual alternation, which I'll talk more about later. Example 12. Charles Dickens, from Bleak House. Chapter 1. In Chancery. London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes. Gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs undistinguishable in mire. Horses, scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. Foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper, and losing their foothold at street corners where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement, and accumulating at compound interest. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river, where it flows among green eights and meadows. Fog down the river, where it rolls, defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes. Fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs. Fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships. Fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats. Fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners, wheezing by the firesides of their wards. Fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper, down in his close cabin. Fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of his shivering little prentice boy on deck. Chance people on the bridges, peeping over the parapets into another sky of fog, with fog all round them, as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds. Gas looming through the fog in divers places in the streets, much as the sun may, from the spongy fields, be seen to loom by husbandman and ploughboy. Most of the shops lighted 2 hours before their time, as the gas seems to know, for it has a haggard and unwilling look. The raw afternoon is rawest, and the dense fog is densest, and the muddy streets are muddiest. Near that leaden-headed old obstruction, appropriate ornament for the threshold of a leaden-headed old corporation, Temple Bar. And hard by Temple Bar, in Lincoln's Inn Hall, at the very heart of the fog, sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery. Chapter 2. In Fashion. My Lady Dedlock has returned to her house in town for a few days previous to her departure for Paris, where her ladyship intends to stay some weeks, after which her movements are uncertain. The fashionable intelligence says so, for the comfort of the Parisians, and it knows all fashionable things. To know things otherwise were to be unfashionable. My Lady Dedlock has been down at what she calls, in familiar conversation, her place in Lincolnshire. The waters are out in Lincolnshire. An arch of the bridge in the park has been sapped and sopped away. The adjacent low-lying ground, for half a mile in breadth, is a stagnant river, with melancholy trees for islands in it, and a surface punctured all over, all day long, with falling rain. My Lady Dedlock's place has been extremely dreary. The weather, for many a day and night, has been so wet that the trees seem wet through, and the soft loppings and prunings of the woodman's axe can make no crash or crackle as they fall. The deer, looking soaked, leave quagmires where they pass. The shot of a rifle loses its sharpness in the moist air, and its smoke moves in a tardy little cloud towards the green rise, coppice-topped, that makes a background for the falling rain. The view from my Lady Dedlock's own windows is alternately a lead-colored view and a view in Indian ink. The vases on the stone terrace in the foreground catch the rain all day, and the heavy drops fall, drip, 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 upon the broad-flagged pavement, called from old time the Ghost's Walk, all night. On Sundays, the little church in the park is moldy. The oaken pulpit breaks out into a cold sweat, and there is a general smell and taste, as of the ancient Dedlocks in their graves. My Lady Dedlock, who is childless, looking out in the early twilight from her boudoir at a keeper's lodge, and seeing the light of a fire upon the latticed panes, and smoke rising from the chimney, and a child, chased by a woman, running out into the rain to meet the shining figure of a wrapped-up man coming through the gate, has been put quite out of temper. My Lady Dedlock says she has been bored to death. Therefore, my Lady Dedlock has come away from the place in Lincolnshire, and has left it to the rain, and the crows, and the rabbits, and the deer, and the partridges, and pheasants. The pictures of the Dedlocks past and gone have seemed to vanish into the damp walls, in mere lowness of spirits, as the housekeeper has passed along the old rooms, shutting up the shutters. And when they will next come forth again, the fashionable intelligence, which, like the fiend, is omniscient of the past and present, but not the future, cannot yet undertake to say. Sir Leicester Dedlock is only a baronet, but there is no mightier baronet than he. His family is as old as the hills, and infinitely more respectable. He has a general opinion that the world might get on without hills, but would be done up without deadlocks. He would, on the whole, admit nature to be a good idea. A little low, perhaps, when not enclosed with a park fence. But an idea dependent for its execution on your great county families. He is a gentleman of strict conscience, disdainful of all littleness and meanness, and ready, on the shortest notice, to die any death you may please to mention, rather than give occasion for the least impeachment of his integrity. He is an honorable, obstinate, truthful, high-spirited, intensely prejudiced, perfectly unreasonable man. Chapter 3. A Progress. I have a great deal of difficulty in beginning to write my portion of these pages, for I know I am not clever. I always knew that. I can remember when I was a very little girl indeed, I used to say to my doll when we were alone together, "Now, Dolly, I am not clever, you know very well, and you must be patient with me, like a dear." And so she used to sit, propped up in a great armchair, with her beautiful complexion and rosy lips, staring at me, or not so much at me, I think, as at nothing, while I busily stitched away and told her every one of my secrets. My dear old doll. I was such a shy little thing that I seldom dared to open my lips, and never dared to open my heart to anybody else. It almost makes me cry to think what a relief it used to be to me when I came home from school of a day to run upstairs to my room and say, "Oh, you dear, faithful Dolly, I knew you would be expecting me." And then to sit down on the floor, leaning on the elbow of her great chair, and tell her all I had noticed since we parted. I had always rather a noticing way. Not a quick way, oh no. A silent way of noticing what passed before me and thinking I should like to understand it better. I have not by any means a quick understanding. When I love a person very tenderly indeed, it seems to brighten. But even that may be my vanity. I was brought up from my earliest remembrance, like some of the princesses in the fairy stories, only I was not charming, by my godmother. At least I only knew her as such. She was a good, good woman. She went to church 3 times every Sunday, and to morning prayers on Wednesdays and Fridays, and to lectures, whenever there were lectures, and never missed. She was handsome, and if she had ever smiled, would have been, I used to think, like an angel. But she never smiled. She was always grave and strict. She was so very good herself, I thought, that the badness of other people made her frown all her life. I felt so different from her, even making every allowance for the differences between a child and a woman. I felt so poor, so trifling, and so far off, that I never could be unrestrained with her. No, could never even love her as I wished. It made me very sorry to consider how good she was, and how unworthy of her I was. And I used ardently to hope that I might have a better heart. And I talked it over very often with the dear old doll. But I never loved my godmother as I ought to have loved her, and as I felt I must have loved her if I had been a better girl. Example 13, a bit from The Lord of the Rings, gives a charming glimpse of the range open to the involved author, who can drop into the POV of a passing fox. The fox never found out any more about it, and we never find out any more about the fox. But there he is, alert and alive, all in one moment, watching for us the obscure beginning of a great adventure. Example 13, J.R.R. Tolkien, from The Lord of the Rings. "I am so sleepy," he said, "that soon I shall fall down on the road. Are you going to sleep on your legs? It is nearly midnight." "I thought you liked walking in the dark," said Frodo. "But there is no great hurry. Merry expects us sometime the day after tomorrow, but that leaves us nearly 2 days more. We'll halt at the first likely spot." "The wind's in the west," said Sam. "If we get to the other side of this hill, we shall find a spot that is sheltered and snug enough, sir. There is a dry fir wood just ahead, if I remember rightly." Sam knew the land well, within 20 miles of Hobbiton, but that was the limit of his geography. Just over the top of the hill, they came on the patch of fir wood. Leaving the road, they went into the deep, resin-scented darkness of the trees and gathered dead sticks and cones to make a fire. Soon they had a merry crackle of flame at the foot of a large fir tree, and they sat round it for a while until they began to nod. Then, each in an angle of the great tree's roots, they curled up in their cloaks and blankets and were soon fast asleep. They set no watch. Even Frodo feared no danger yet, for they were still in the heart of the Shire. A few creatures came and looked at them when the fire had died away. A fox passing through the wood on business of his own stopped several minutes and sniffed. "Hobbits," he thought. "Well, what next? I have heard of strange doings in this land, but I have seldom heard of a hobbit sleeping out of doors under a tree. Three of them. There's something mighty queer behind this." He was quite right, but he never found out any more about it. If you go back to example 8 from the Time Passes section of To the Lighthouse, you'll see the involved author moving in and out of her own perceptions and characters' points of view so swiftly and so easily that the points of view dissolve into one another and into a voice which is the voice of the beauty of the world, but which is also the voice of the book itself, the story telling itself. This kind of quick, unsignaled shifting, discussed further below, is rare and takes immense certainty and skill. Further reading. The involved author, or omniscient author. I'm a little shy about telling anybody to go read Tolstoy's War and Peace, since it's quite an undertaking, but it is a wonderful book. And from the technical aspect, it's almost miraculous in the way it shifts imperceptibly from the author's voice to the point of view of a character, speaking with perfect simplicity in the inner voice of a man, a woman, even a hunting dog, and then back to the thoughts of the author, till by the end you feel you have lived many lives, which is perhaps the greatest gift a novel can give. The detached narrator, or fly on the wall. Any of the writers who called themselves minimalist, such as Raymond Carver, wrote stories that provide good examples of this technique. The observer narrator, Henry James and Willa Cather, both used this device frequently. James used limited third person for his observer narrators, which distances the whole story. Cather used a male witness narrator in the first person, notably in My Antonia and a lost lady. And it is interesting to speculate on why a woman writer might speak through a male mask. The Unreliable Narrator, Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, is a classic example. We'd better not believe everything the governess tells us, and we must look through what she says for what she leaves out. Is she deceiving us or herself? Point of view in genre fiction is interesting. One might expect most science fiction to be written without getting inside the characters, but if you read it, you'll find this is not true at all. Quite unpretentious series novels, such as those that use the characters from Star Trek, may be highly sophisticated in their changes of POV. Many mysteries are written omnisciently, but the limitation and development of the narrator's knowledge is often the central device of a mystery, and many of the finest, like Tony Hillerman's Southwestern, or Donna Leon's Venetian, or Sarah Paretsky's Chicago Mysteries, are told from the viewpoint of the detective. Romances are conventionally told in limited third person, through the perceptions of the heroine, but first-person observer-narrator and involved author-narration are equally suited to the genre. A founding classic of the Western novel, Owen Wister's The Virginian, is mostly told in the first person by an Eastern greenhorn observer-narrator, and many later writers in the genre imitated this ploy. Wister switches, a little awkwardly, into authorial narration to tell us events that the observer narrator couldn't have observed. Molly Glass's beautiful Western novel, The Jump Off Creek, moves back and forth between first person in diary entries and limited third person. An interesting example of personal memoir told in letters, and at one very painful point, told in the third person, as if it were about someone other than the author, is Eleanor Pruitt Stewart's Letters of a Woman Homesteader. Changing the point of view, using various narrators, is an essential structural device of many modern stories and novels. Margaret Atwood does it wonderfully. Look at The Robber Bride, or her short stories, or Alias Grace, a novel so well-made and well-written that it could serve as a model for almost any topic in this book. Did you ever read or see the film of Rashomon? It's the classic tale of four witnesses telling four utterly different versions of the same event. Making History by Carolyn C. is told in the voices of a set of narrators whose differing voices are an essential part of the book's wit and power. In my novella, Hairness, in Sea Road, four women tell the story of a small-town family through the whole 20th century, their voices passing back and forth among the generations. Perhaps the masterpiece of this kind of choral narration is The Waves by Virginia Woolf.